Loralee.com has a comprehensive search engine that will help you find what you're looking for among the 500 hours of audio interviews and the thousands of pages, including books, articles, and lots of great information that are featured on our site. Subscribe to our free emailed newsletter and you'll receive even more news and features. Hi and welcome. I'm Loralee. This show is dedicated to those central mysteries of life. Who are we? Where do we come from? Where are we going? That's the adventure of life, and it's a big, fascinating universe out there. That's why we call this show Conversation for Exploration. So at the Rogue Valley Metaphysical Research Library, Jordan Peace has just brought in Dan Shaw, who's an alchemist of 17 years, who publishes Vortex Maps and has the upcoming Vortex Field Guide, and who believes that our human energy field and the planetary field is one and the same. And he says by using that field, we can infect some psychic and physical healing. I think we're all in need of that, planet, environment, all of the species on Earth, as well as us humans, Dan. I think you're on to a very important line of research and work. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Gosh, tell us how you started with alchemy, what your interest in there was, and how this led to looking at vortex, this energy vortex. I know that we've just planned to go up to the Oregon Vortex and take a look at that. I believe that's a real spot. I visited that as a kid. You say not only the Oregon Vortex, there's 10 more like it in the U.S. alone. So our planet's replete with many interesting mystery spots, healing centers, energy nodes. How did you arrive at this big picture, and tell us what you've learned of the big picture? And I'll just sit back and listen now.
Wow, well, there's an infinite, those were a lot of good questions. There's an infinite number of these energy nodes. There are many different systems for mapping these energy points and active points. There are systems using icosahedron and the dodecahedron and lining up the pattern with North and South Pole and the pyramids.
And those are the classic geometric forms.
Right, the Platonic solids, so-called. And kind of the best-known system is the Becker-Hagen's Earth-Star Globe, which you see in front of you and which people can see on my website. But there are many different systems for mapping the energy body of the planet. And just as our human energy body has a certain terrain which can be mapped through acupuncture points and meridians, and just as
Earth has her own meridian system, then, you're saying?
Yes, I'd say that's a perfect analogy. And again, since the human energy field and the planetary energy field are one, it's more than just an analogy. I'd say it's more like the microcosm and the macrocosm.
You're not saying humans are special, or are you saying all life would share then the same energy system, would be all of one? Or
nice,
are you saying humans
nice
are
point.
Special?
Nice okay. point. We're special, at least in that we're an awareness of our challenge for our spiritual growth. And I believe that these vortexes provide kind of each one its own special and unique flavor of energy that affects us both psychically and physically. It turns out that there are a number of these active points or vortex points around the U.S. which are developed as tourist attractions, and then there are, of course, even more that aren't developed as tourist attractions. The field guide will list these, and I'll also distinguish between the real ones and the fake ones and tell people how to identify vortexes that haven't yet been discovered by looking at air photos, sectional air charts which show magnetic disturbances, and also how to photograph the effects and how to measure the vortex to further the research.
And I think what to do when you get to a vortex point. It'll be interesting to see what kind of experiments or tests or photos you can take. at these, and I'm going to enjoy the Oregon Vortex visit with you and Paul.
Well, I have a pretty analytical mind, and I'm definitely interested in seeing what science underlies the claims and how we can set up certain protocols to run repeatable experiments so that other people can further the research.
You have a Bachelor of Science in Geography. It's going to serve you well here, isn't it?
I do. We just got some information from Confusion Hill in Piercy, California, that they had some magnetometer readings done at their site. And Nick Nelson, who's co-authoring the field guide with me, had been to the Confusion Hill Vortex, and he douses. He's sensitive to the energies, as many dowsers are. Everybody is sensitive in their own ways. Nick uses a couple different pendulums, which are composed of magnets. He identified a couple active spots at that vortex. Later on, this fellow with the magnetometer, this PhD, Nikolai Barashkov, was there. The owner pointed out the active points that Nick had identified, and sure enough, in just a very few feet, the magnetometer picked up variance in the magnetic field of 1,000 nanoteslas. So we're not talking minute variations in the magnetic field anymore, variations are small.
Ambient noise, cell phone going off. We don't care. Just continue.
You know, that's my reminder to be just a little more aware. So the timing's always perfect.
I was wondering, with Earth's magnetic field is changing, and they're mapping it, and we might be going through a magnetic field flip soon, who knows, that really the magnetic field is on the move. And if you think that some of these node points, and you're going to explain the geometry of how you think this grid is laid out here later on, if you think that's going to have an effect to how this plays out. But we can get to that later. I was just trying to fill in some dead air there.
Oh, that's perfect. The magnetic field is certainly dynamic, and there's long-term cycles that are driven by the sun, and there's short-term fluctuations, which are also, they can be sun-driven or earth-driven. The magnetic field does vary over long periods of geologic time. That paleomagnetic field can be mapped through lava flows, because when the...
Robert Coe's work. Interesting.
Oh, yes. Yeah. When the magma hardens into lava, it takes on the magnetic field of the planet at the time. And there are, over periods of time, reversals of the magnetic field. And when the magnetic field does reverse, we may all feel very much differently. We may feel very much better and find out that we're in the reversal now.
Maybe that's why this is the topsy-turvy backwards world. So you're telling us a bit about how you are, how you feel that the planetary energy field ties to the human energy field. Lay that parameter, if you would, and how we can affect a psychic and physical healing tying into this. Is this why people from time immemorial has gone to sacred sites? Because there's something magnetically going on, and they seek a healing, or they seek magnification of this force?
I would say yes, that people from time immemorial have been sensitive to these energies, and they've gone to these sites, and they've built monuments there. They've erected
that probably accentuate or enhance the magnetics there.
Yes, I would think, and my experience is that they were very much tuned into the energy. The things they built there were working with the energy and enhanced the energy, but they didn't necessarily need to know that the points were in geometric relationship to each other. But to answer one of your first questions, the way that I got so involved with this material was that I was interested in sacred geometry, and it fascinated me not just that the pyramids themselves were built with this elaborate geometry, but that the megaliths around the world shared this geometry. And I don't think we necessarily have to make the leap to say that there were aliens at some ancient time, or that the ancient civilizations were necessarily coordinated and aware that they were placing these things in near-perfect geometric relationship to each other.
The sites themselves would have spoken to the people there.
Exactly. Everybody senses these energies in different ways and works with them in different ways. I don't want to get too caught up in this rigorous scientific analysis of the energies, because I want to spend part of my time being open to receive the infinite energies that are available to us everywhere all the time.
Why do we seek them? What is the special quality of these energies, and how do they enhance our life?
As human beings, we experience certain limitations in the amount of energy that we're willing to hold in our physical bodies. But the physical, like the non-physical, is also infinite. And if we can let go of the limitations that we experience around the physical, then we can drop all of the physical limitations and our physical could become infinite. And that is what ascension is. That, to me, is the purpose of our spiritual experience here.
The word ascension's been bandied out a lot. What do you mean specifically by it?
Specifically, for the physical to become infinite, to expand out into everything, and to experience the unity with
everything.
Doesn't
the soul do that already, though? Why do we need the physical to follow?
Well, because there is no separation between the physical and the non-physical. People are... That separation itself is something that we impose by the distinctions of the mind. We make a distinction between what's physical and non-physical, and we may say that we're willing for the soul, which is non-physical, to be infinite. But ascension and alchemy is about the merging of all polarities. It's about merging the physical and the non-physical and recognizing that it's all divine God and all infinite.
So this is a major spiritual quest that you're on.
It is. To me, the maps are one of the best healing tools that I've found. The geometric patterns serve well as a mandala. I think they instantly shift people's consciousness about how all places are connected and how they are connected to their place.
Some of the sacred sites that you focus on here on the West Coast, the Teton Medicine Wheel, Tahoe, Rainier, Sedona, Shasta. Tell us about this geometrical relationship that you say is there between these sites.
Well, I've published two maps. One is the world map that folds up into a globe. The other is the map of Western...
Looking very Bucky-esque, isn't it? Right. Like Fuller's maps.
It is based in part on the Buckminster Fuller geometry. The other one is the Western North America map, which shows the Tetons as the center of a massive medicine wheel of 19 points equally spaced around the Grand Tetons. Those points are either the highest mountain in their region or the largest body of water. Some of those include Shasta, Tahoe, Lake Mead, Sedona, Banff, and Lake Louise. And if you take a map of the U.S., you can see that yourself, or of course you can see it at vortexmaps.com.
So you think there are forces in the earth, that geological forces then come on and create a lake here, a mountain there, and they're patterned?
Everything in creation has a geometric pattern waiting for us to perceive it, in effect. It takes something of a visionary to see pattern at this scale.
The human brain likes to see pattern anyway, impose pattern.
We have evolved to be pattern-recognizing beings, and it's easy to see pattern where there is none. We're looking for patterns which verify themselves by repeating themselves, circles that repeat as Vesica Pisces, the two interlocking circles, or circles that double or repeat in a phi ratio.
The golden mean proportions,
yes.
Okay.
Yes, so...
Well, all of nature does the golden mean, doesn't it?
Yes.
So why not? Okay, the surface of the planet, you're saying.
And it's... In order to verify that an alignment, just a straight line of sights, is an actual alignment, it takes some computer work to see whether it's above the realm of chance. But when you see these geometric patterns repeating, and it's very much a visual thing, it answers all questions.
Now, this is interesting, because I could readily agree that energy points would show up in a geometrical array. But to have physical features, lakes, mountains, these kinds of things, also arranged in a geometric pattern.
Perfect question.
Is
And the thing is that we're aware that shape creates energy in some sense, that we can build a pyramid. Some of us have built pyramids and done experiments and find that the pyramid shape itself creates energy.
You're saying the energy also creates the shape.
Exactly right, yes. It is the energy really which comes first, which creates the landforms.
He's got all sorts of things buzzing and going on here. So this will be one of my questions prior to an interview. Do you have cell phones? Watches that will be.
Before I go to the Shakespeare Festival. I'm so excited to be here.
But they give me a reminder, which I didn't, so my fault. I'll take responsibility. So,
maybe that person should be on the air.
So you're finding this not just on the West Coast where you live, but you're finding this all over the planet?
I've compiled more than 100 geometric maps from around the planet. And yes, you would think that these geometric maps might be rare, but turns out that it's not quite so rare as you might think. The ancients looked to the sky and looked at the constellations, and they thought, well, let's build our temples in a reflection of these constellations.
Oh, so heavens marrying Earth.
Exactly. Yeah. So sometimes we have those kinds of visionary maps, which are effectively astrological patterns of, for example, the Notre Dame cathedrals in France mirroring the constellation Virgo.
Marie Chatelaine. I love that book, yeah.
And there are many kinds of visionary maps. There's maps of landforms that look like birds and snakes, for example. And there are these geometric visionary maps. And
the Nazca lines, would you throw those in there in this mix as well?
Another kind of, yes, I would say so, another kind of sacred landscape and some evidence that it's built to reflect the sky. The medicine wheel, Stonehenge, and many of these megaliths served some kind of astronomical function. And the pyramids themselves make a very effective globe of the northern hemisphere. The Mayan pyramid at Chichen Itza, the Castillo, has 90 steps on a side. And one step is split, so it can actually be counted as 91 as well. So on four sides, you get the 360 degrees, and you also get the 364 days on each of the four sides of the pyramid. And so each of those 90 steps counts for 1 degree of latitude, if you want to apply our system of latitude and longitude to the Mexican pyramids, it works perfectly. So these pyramids served as a kind of symbolic, a unifier of time and space. When you stood at the pyramid, you know where you stood in relationship to all the rest of the world and to the seasons and the days of the year and the planetary cycles.
Okay, because I was just going to ask then, aren't we connected to the whole heavens? Because the ancients were so fascinated by charting the heavens, charting this giant wheel clock that we find ourselves in a cosmic level. And aren't they also trying to bring in earth energies as well as heavenly energies and mix the two? It seemed to be an obsession with them.
Mm-hmm. Well,
for good reason, exactly.
We're charting these very long cycles of approximately 13,000 years and twice that length and twice that length.
We know, and there's a real 26,000 year cycle.
Yes, and what that cycle is, it's the cycle of the tilt of the planet.
The precession.
Well, the precession of the equinoxes is, in effect, the changing background of the ecliptic. But what's going on there is there's many different geometries between Earth and Sun. There's many different planetary motions. There's not just orbit, there's the precession. There's also something which is called galactic solstice and galactic equinox. And so there's a point in Earth's 52,000 year cycle, let's say, where the north pole of the planet is facing most directly to the Sun. That would be the galactic solstice. And then in that cycle, the other end of the cycle, the north pole of the Earth is pointing farther away from the Sun than it would otherwise in that whole cycle. What happens is there's solar particles coming from the Sun. They're bombarding the magnetic field of the Earth. The magnetic field of the Earth, if we could stand back and look at it, looks effectively like the tail of the comet, where the Sun is blowing, it's like blowing the flame off a match, and it the magnetic field splays out on the shadowed side of the Earth. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So we have this magnetic field around the Earth, which is buffering us from the solar wind. The solar particles are getting deflected away from the Earth. That's what's the planetary magnetic field is what's protecting the satellites in orbit. It's protecting us from too much solar radiation. Now, the magnetic field of the planet is not a perfect sphere. The magnetic field lines are open at the north and south poles, where the magnetic particles, the solar wind, solar particles can enter most easily. That's why we have these electrical displays called the aurora borealis and aurora australis at the poles.
You know what?
Are we going off track?
Yeah, I think we should regroup and do this another day. Because I feel like we're like going all over. This is all interesting stuff, but I feel like my listeners are going to go, she's all over the map, and she's not doing a good job here. So.
Well, I'd be totally delighted to come see you.
Okay.
In your studio or
and
whatever you like.
I feel time pressure here.
Well, that's
actually,
never good.
Actually, your studio's in Bellevue, so it's going to be hard.
I'm planning on coming up to see Doug.
Oh, we'll be there in late June, July. I don't mean leaving it now. I mean doing it another day while we're here.
Well, that would be fabulous.
Yeah. So, I mean, we can pick up and try to go, but I also believe people know the basics of the stuff, and so I feel like why waste time there when you've got all this other fascinating stuff to do, and I don't feel like I'm serving you well because I'm not, you know, I don't have my head together right now. We could pick up and go and try from here.
Well,
I'd
love conveying the... I think you're doing perfectly.
Really?
Gosh, yeah. Well,
really?
In the sense, sure, because I got to talk about ascension using the energies. You're probably the best interviewer I've ever had.
I get to talk
a little bit about the longer cycles, people who know about the Mayan calendar, although I haven't used the word Mayan. They're tied in.
Okay.
Let's pick up the tying in
the heaven and earth, and let's just make a short answer there.
Okay, let's do that.
Yeah.
Tying in the heaven. Yeah, well, see, that's okay.
Because, you know, I'll pick up on it.
All right, as you wish.
So let's go back to the heaven and earth thing. 3, 2, 1. So in a sense, our energy field probably doesn't end with the bounds of Earth. It probably goes out much further into the cosmos, I would suspect. And the ancients felt that very strongly, didn't they?
Much of the ancient wisdom is about these longer cycles and how the solar geometry, the solar Earth geometry, is important in the world stage of history.
Right, which is where prophecy and ages and the shift of the ages all come in.
And that's where I want to say that I believe in gentle birth and that transition can be effortless and blissful.
Could be. Okay, so we're back to geometry because looking at the cosmic plane, and you will have to contemplate how did the ancients really figure this out, because there's lots of clues that they did. But you started by being fascinated by sacred geometry. You're looking at our Earth grid energy field in terms of sacred geometry. The ancients saw our whole placement in the galaxy in terms of geometry. Astrology is based on geometric alignments and patterns and how it influences us. So, we're walking matrices of geometry. Nature unfolds with the Fibonacci series and the golden mean spiral. Everything's expressed in geometric terms. What does that all mean to you? What do you make of that?
For me, understanding the geometry of creation is part of alchemy, learning to master the physical. The geometric form is universal, as is music, and there's a direct relationship between geometry and music. In fact, geometry and music are probably one universal language. And I believe that our consciousness has certain geometric keys, that looking at certain geometric shapes can actually trigger an awakening process.
Okay. So the music of the sphere is down to music therapy. Music is geometry. Take the guitar string and start splicing it up as Plato did, and you've got geometry and music. Okay.
And even more to the point, we can take the step pyramids in Mexico and we can translate those into audible frequencies and have a musical scale based on the dimensions of the pyramid.
Have you done that? I know Stan Tenen tried to do that, assigning notes to his whole pattern thing going on. Has anybody done that?
Absolutely. At vortexmaps.com, people can see a harmonic keyboard, which was invented by Barbara Hero, which is a mathematical synthesizer keyboard, plugs into a laptop.
Okay.
And you can program in any fundamental frequency you want, and all the other notes then are in harmony with that fundamental frequency. And that harmonic keyboard is designed to show the relationship between mathematics and geometry and music. And Barbara Hero has done many different analyses of structures, Chartres Cathedral, pyramids, etc., to crop circles, to translate them into audible frequencies. And you can see how that's done at the website.
Exciting. On your website, you also have order forms for your maps. Could you explain the various maps that you have? These are so intriguing.
Well, I've published two maps. One is a world map that folds up into a globe. It's printed on 30 diamonds, and it's very much like a geodesic dome, a la Buckminster Fuller.
This is the Bucky-esque one.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And it makes a little model, three-dimensional model, when you're done.
It does. It stands about 11 inches tall on its little stand. The other one's 26 by 28, full-color map of Western North America, showing the Grand Tetons as the center of this massive medicine wheel connecting Sedona, Tahoe, Shasta, points north.
And surprising to see in what nice geometric alignment those places are all in. So $15 and a $30 set, including both of them, so they're very
affordable. That's right.
Those hidden dimensions of our world, the very ground underneath our feet. So what do you do at sacred sites when you go?
There are people all over the world who are visiting sacred sites and doing ritual of one sort or another. Many of these people are planting crystals and doing ceremonies to heal the earth, to send love to the earth. I'm not a big ritualist, and I don't generally do energy clearings or that level of grid work. That's a lot of responsibility.
Everybody has their job.
I go to be connected to the place, to breathe the air, drink the water, maybe eat a little local food growing wild if I can, meditate. Dreaming is also a wonderful thing to do at these sacred sites, and ritual of all sorts. It's a great way to connect with other people around the planet.
More about this coming up just after this. I'm Laura Lee. I hope you're enjoying the show. And for more information on our guests and topics, you'll find links, books, and source materials at lauralee.com. Just use our search engine to get right where you want to go. And for a list of upcoming shows, as well as special events and exclusive news and updates on our travels around the country, sign up for my newsletter. It's free and delivered by email. It's all at lauralee.com. Stay in touch. Let's get back to our conversation with Dan Shaw. The UK is noted for having a lot of ley lines, energy lines that have been doused, very thoroughly doused, and in a very interesting grid pattern. I would suspect that those same grids would be present in other places of the world. Maybe in the UK they're better known and more people have spent time dowsing them. But it would seem to me if they're there, they should be all over. What do you think about that?
You can certainly see how this geometric globe breaks down in finer dimensions in the microcosm to see the finer gradations over
like
Europe,
capillaries
for
to
example.
The veins or something, right?
Well, but even Buckminster Fuller talked about how these shapes continue to divide themselves up into smaller shapes, and that grid overlaid over any one of these diamonds will show a mesh of finer lines. And as I said, there are many different systems of grid lines around the planets. Different dowsers sometimes, almost always, actually find different systems. It doesn't mean that one is more valid than another necessarily, but certainly there are systems, planetary systems, and patterns where you see the line that goes through Europe comes back around through the other side of the globe. And then there are, of course, smaller patterns like the constellation patterns that we talked about.
People are fond of setting up labyrinths and walking the labyrinths. Mm. What effect do you think, if we are tied our energy field to the planetary field, that walking a sacred labyrinth pattern would do? Mm-hmm. How does that activate a healing?
Yeah. Labyrinth is just slightly different in that you're stimulating the inner ear, which is always good for connecting the brain hemispheres, by walking or running around in that balance pattern.
How are you stimulating the inner ear?
Just as a child would, swinging on a swing, or anybody, you know, spinning until they're dizzy or whatever.
Sure. The mechanism.
Sure.
Okay.
So it maybe goes a little off topic there, but labyrinth is a wonderful thing to do at these sacred sites, certainly for taking that ritual walk and connecting to the energy of the place.
Some people believe that by activating, by doing ritual, you can bring the magnetic forces to a spot where maybe it wasn't as strong before. Do you believe that?
Again, since I believe that there's no separation between the human energy field and the planetary energy field, the relationship is reciprocal. Not only are we experiencing the energies of the greater planetary field and being affected by them, but we're also affecting the planetary field, much like acupuncture needles.
Okay. So it's an interactive two-way street here.
Absolutely.
What do you think the ancient alchemists knew about this planetary grid system, and how were they using it?
Well, they expended a tremendous amount of energy and resources in order to build these monuments at the points, to sanctify the points. And at the time, those monuments were in use as temples, where today they're more like
ruins.
Museums, ruins and museums. If we could read the writing on the wall, let's say, from some ancient temple, it might say, reactivate me. Let's
dance.
Be holding ritual at these points and activating the earth at these points, helping create balance in the planetary energy field by doing ritual at these points instead of letting them lay and decay or as museums.
And of course, music would have played a big part in those rituals.
Music is huge for activating the energy and creating that vibration. And Jean-Michel has written in his books about the circle of perpetual choirs in England. And the cathedrals, certainly, you can read a musical scale in those. And the stones under tension behave differently than stones under compression. And they do, they ring. It's a...
If I put
two uprights in the ground, as at Stonehenge, those two upright, and then I put a third stone across the top, those two uprights are under compression, but the stone mm-hmm. across the top is under tension, much like a xylophone note. Stonehenge is...
You're saying a big musical instrument?
It's a giant xylophone.
Do you think that's how it was used?
I'm being a little facetious, but certainly...
I can just see him taking big sticks and pounding on it, much like the obelisk, fallen obelisk in Egypt or something. It rings like a bell.
It does ring, and you don't really need to hit it
mm-hmm.
for it to ring.
Oh, you
it's
can sound it.
Well, it's vibrating all the time. It's proportions. It vibrates according to its proportions.
You don't need to bring it up to the level where the human ear can
doesn't
hear
have
it
to be
because
audible.
It's activated, mm-hmm. just like the guitar string activated by wind if you have instruments mm-hmm. sensitive enough to detect it. Okay.
Yeah.
Or you could sing to it. That would activate it.
Sure. The human voice is the richest of all instruments.
Interesting. Interesting. So, why are we in such a mess today? What happened? You know, we had this ancient thing going on where we were honoring the sites and bringing the heavens mm-hmm. and the earth's energies together and,
yeah.
you know, really honoring earth and carrying on rituals to keep the balance maintained.
Hmm.
What in your quick history of the human race, what happened?
Well, at the risk of oversimplifying, I think that sometimes we need the nightmare in order to wake up. in a certain sense, we're all sleepwalking. We're all having this limited perception, this perception of the physical being limited. We're in a state of forgetfulness and kind of a dark ages. But it seems that there was, at one time, a civilization which was more tuned into these energies and working with the energies. And that time has come again, that there are more and more people all the time building energy devices and working with the planetary and human energy field.
So it's just as natural as going to sleep, waking up, going to sleep, waking up. It's a cycle. We just happen to be in the we're asleep but about to wake up stage.
It is a cycle, but it's not an endless cycle. At the end, the outcome is that we all wake up. The inevitable ascension.
Boy, this is going to need editing.
You've got some great questions, though.
Okay.
Yeah.
How about if you don't wait for me to ask a particular question, you just keep talking? How about if we do that? Because I'm just, yeah.
Sure. Okay. I've traveled to some of these sites, but not all of the sites. Certainly, and I've got much more travel to look forward to. I don't consider myself to be particularly sensitive to the energies, but I think more so all the time, and I feel it as a tingling in my face, generally. Hmm. Tingling in my bridge of my nose or my third eye. Obviously, different people sense it different ways. Dowsers may use a forked stick or a pendulum to accentuate what sensation they feel. But I do feel it physically affecting me. And I have to wonder, from a scientist's point of view, now what are these energies? Anything that can heal can kill. And that certainly some of these points may have energy at certain times which is not compatible with you and may cause you to feel dizziness. Or certain points, the Oregon Vortex has a certain reputation as being one of these points where the energy is not particularly good. However, if you go there and you feel some effect, on some level that's a good thing, because at least you felt that the energy is real. You felt it. You know it's real, and that in theory we can build devices to affect healing and to create these same effects. And in fact, my co-author Nick Nelson does know how to build a vortex using magnets.
Now, what does that mean? Knows how to build a vortex?
Well,
using
a vortex is a place where the known laws of physics don't hold true.
Okay.
Time may run a little slower inside a vortex. There are certain ways to test that, which we're working to write a protocol that can be replicated.
That's why you're working with Doug Vogt on this, I understand, an old friend of ours. Yeah.
It may be that it takes more force to move an object in one direction than in another, say a suspended weight, or that a broom will stand at an angle instead of straight up and down. We need to have some scientific protocol to see if we can replicate these things.
So it's not an optical illusion or a illusion of the instruments, it's actually a measurable effect.
But
it won't be reproducible all the time, because this is a living field that changes.
It does fluctuate, which makes it very difficult to draw a map.
Or to test it and have perfect scientific protocol.
We're working to give greater credibility to the study of vortexes. And it doesn't help that some of these authentic vortexes have a crooked shack, because the crooked shack, what you usually are seeing is optical illusion.
Right.
So I'm not interested in optical illusion. Detracts, I think, from the authenticity of what affects me.
Or that they're like amusement parks that are built.
Our interest is in obtaining an authentic vortex, whether it's operating as a tourist attraction or not, in order to conduct further research, and especially research on magnetic motors. We believe that because the phenomena is so dynamic that it may prove to be the solution to the
energy crisis?
To the magnetic motor question. Which?
What is the magnetic motor question?
The magnetic motor question is if it's possible to use permanent magnets to generate some kind of motion which can be turned mm-hmm. into electricity. So,
by working with a magnetic anomaly, they may tell you something about magnets that we didn't previously know.
It may, and I make no pretenses to be an expert on magnets, but Nick Nelson, on the other hand, is getting very close to solving this question. He worked for 2 years as a guide at the Oregon Vortex.
Uh-huh.
And he believes that because the field is so dynamic that it may provide the answer to building a magnetic motor.
That's a pretty strong vortex, as vortexes go.
I think it is an important vortex in the overall pattern, and in the vortex field guide I show how it is related to the Teton's medicine wheel and to the globe geometry.
So some of these stronger vortexes, maybe they're not putting out negative energy as opposed to negative, positive, whatever that means, but maybe it's just that it's messing with our magnetic field. I mean, we have magnetite in the brain, and we're tuned to feeling and detecting the magnetic field around us, much like homing pigeons and mm-hmm. whales and other mm-hmm. migratory species. So just by having an effect could disturb you, or you could notice it feel a little odd or something.
Some people do feel a little dizzy or nauseous mm-hmm. at the Oregon Vortex, for example, and I could see how that could happen. It could be a little disorienting.
How many tests have been done at the Oregon Vortex or similar vortexes to demonstrate it's a real effect? It's not just that somebody built a crooked shack to make these optical illusions, because, you know, some of the photographs, you look smaller, you look bigger mm-hmm. when you should look the same size. You know, there's an interesting phenomenon going on.
Unfortunately, they haven't attracted the serious attention of researchers that perhaps they should, and hopefully the Vortex Field Guide will solve that by providing these protocols and explaining to people how to take the photographs, how to measure the phenomena. An optical illusion will fool the eye, and it won't fool your camera, it won't fool the photograph. But the shrinking row phenomena seems to be real, and it's important to take your photographs right so you've got a good side-by-side comparison.
What do you suppose is really happening in that field? You know, physically?
There are a number of theories. The one that I prefer is that it is analogous to refraction, that when light travels through air, it travels differently than when it travels through water. And if I put a pencil into that glass of water there, at the surface of the water, we're going to see that the ruler, or whatever, pencil looks discontinuous at that point.
It bends sharply because the
it appears
light
to bend
beams are refracting.
Because the light is moving. We say light doesn't bend, but in fact it does. It refracts. Now, there is no lens per se at the vortex. However, what we think we're seeing is an interface between two parts of the vortex. There seem to be an eye of the vortex where it's still an inner vortex, an outer vortex, and a corona. And at the points between the inner and outer vortex and between the outer and the corona, we have a line of demarcation, and that seems to be where the effect takes place.
Interesting.
So the shrinking row photograph, as a photographer, you would stand either in the outer vortex or in the corona, and then the people you're photographing would be standing on either side of that line of demarcation, and then they would switch, and that would cause the apparent effect.
You know, that makes sense, doesn't it?
Well, you have to judge for yourself.
Huh. So, couldn't somebody take some sort of other, I don't know, devices that test magnetics and see, oh, effects in here, but not out here?
Well, as I say, the magnetometer does seem to confirm Nick's pendulum mm-hmm. of Confusion Hill. Doesn't seem that lasers bend going through a
Is
vortex.
That what you would expect or not?
If my lens analogy were accurate, you might expect that you would see laser light being deflected. But it may be that because the laser light's coherent, that that's not going to happen the same way as ordinary reflected
light.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Interesting. So.
So we hope to find investors to help us purchase some authentic active vortex to do further
Oregon
research.
Vortex is up for sale.
It is, and so is the vortex near Hungry Horse, Montana, I understand. But we don't need an operating tourist attraction necessarily. There are other points.
Oh, I see. There's vortexes that...
Sure. We've identified all kinds of active points around the U.S. Only 10 of them are operating as tourist attractions.
Gotcha.
And the Vortex Field Guide tells people how to find more of these things, either by the geometry or by air photos or magnetic maps, that kind of thing.
So are most of these on, people's backyards or in public land or mountaintops or forests or... lakes? Where do you find most of these?
Well, interestingly, you tend to find them on mountaintops.
Okay.
The magnetic field on the surface is controlled by the sun in part, and in part by the Earth's magnetic field.
Okay.
Now, the Earth's got a very interesting structure. We discovered only a few years ago that inside the molten core of the Earth, there is a solid core. And that solid core is an iron crystal, which is the size of the moon, more or less.
Hmm.
We can see this by seismic and sound waves sent through the Earth, that there's this cooling mass of magma, which is the perfect place to grow a crystal, and there's this massive crystal in there. It's spinning at a different rate than the surface of the Earth. So you've got this massive washing machine effect, agitator effect of the inner core spinning at one speed and the surface spinning at another speed. There are stable spots in that molten core, and those stable spots underneath the continental plate and the oceanic plate is what causes phenomena like the chain of Hawaiian Islands. And Yellowstone is also a stable hot spot in the molten core. So those stable spots in the molten core can help create the surface, the overall magnetic field at the surface. Also surface features like remnant of volcanic necks that are exposed by erosion, wherever you see unusual surface features like that, or large bodies of water, that'll have an effect on the magnetic field. And since air pilots navigate by magnetic compass, their sectional air charts actually show these magnetic disturbances. And now there's a distinction to be made between kind of vortex like the Oregon vortex, which Nick is talking about, and the kind of vortex which you see depicted on this Western North America map. The Western North America map points actually correspond with magnetic disturbances. However, on a standard air chart, you will not find a magnetic disturbance at Gold Hill indicated.
Because?
I'm not sure why, because often these ore and mineral deposits do affect the local magnetic field. Maybe it's not.
Do you have prospectors, oil and mineral prospectors that would be interested in looking at this?
Absolutely,
and saying,
yes.
Oh, here's a clue.
The oil and mineral prospectors are using magnetic maps extensively, no question about that. It does seem that these ore and mineral deposits occur at these energy points. It seems that they occur in geometric patterns and that these ore and mineral deposits give off the signature magnetic disturbance. Nick, originally, when he went to the Oregon Vortex 20 years ago, thought that he might find a massive buried gold nugget to account for the anomaly going on there. He no longer thinks that. Doug Vogt thinks that he's going to find a buried pyramid if he were to excavate at the Oregon Vortex. I don't necessarily
agree. Doesn't sound likely to me,
but... Like crop circles, I think that this could be a manifestation of Earth's natural and divine intelligence. We don't necessarily have to posit some other ancient civilization or aliens or anything like that. Doug's experiments do show how the vortex responds when people enter the field.
Oh, how so?
He has been using frequency counter, and he takes a baseline reading. And then when people enter into the vortex field, the readings change. So that supports my thesis that there is no separation, that they
do
Earth
you
responds
control
to us.
So that you also over time take frequency readings to see if it's going to fluctuate on its own without people?
We would expect that it would fluctuate according to the natural cycles.
I would too.
And we also expect that if we took the same photograph repeatedly over time, that we would see certain shrink and grow phenomenon going on in the vortex itself without any people influencing the field.
Okay. Let's see. Maybe we've got 5 more minutes here.
Okay.
So there's a couple of things you mentioned. I'm just going to go back. Usually I'm a lot more coherent. I don't know what's wrong with my head right now.
But I thought I should have brought you a salad or something.
No.
What's your favorite part about this? Let me ask you that. How do you tap into these energies? How do you sense them? Or can you share something about
my interest in them?
The great time you had at Tahoe or anything. Your favorite sacred place.
I guess my interest is that I believe that our ancient cultures knew how to enhance these energies, knew how to use these energies.